left about what ML-based model comparison was. I think I didn't emphasize enough what exactly this means, probability of HI given D. You shouldn't think that what we are doing here is exactly same as what we did for parameter estimation. In parameter estimation, we had just a single model, say a DMM or HMM or even just a Gaussian. There the problem was to find the parameters. We just had given the model, what the parameters are. P of theta I or theta given D. We just had to estimate the parameters. In this model comparison, we assume that we know how to calculate the parameters, but we don't know how to choose the right model, whether it's GMM with two mixtures or five mixtures, or it's like the previous class example. I just had data with 1, 3, 5, 7 as Xn. So I needed to predict what the next sample was. So in that case, we can fit a linear model, a polynomial, say 10th order polynomial model. So in this case, we assume that we know how to find the parameters of whatever model we are trying to find. But now, how do we choose between linear model or a polynomial model is what model comparison is all about. Now, if what we actually want is given set of models, we want to find the model that is most probable given this data. So if you have 1, 3, 5, 7, I want to find the model that is whether it's the linear model or the polynomial model is most probable given this data. Now, with Bayes' rule, it would be proportional to this. So this is easy. So the posterior of the model given data is probability of data given the model and multiplied by the prior probability of the model. If, like in the example that we took, 1, 3, 5, 7, we can probably sometimes give a prior belief about probability of the model. Like we can give more weightage to a model like linear model because it's simpler. But like the name itself states, just a belief, prior belief. We do not want to be so subjective always. And we can in fact try to do better by showing that it's even probabilistically true that linear model is better for data like 1, 3, 5, 7. Now, whether it's ML-based method or Bayesian method, what we are going to deal with is this probability of D given HI. Bayesian doesn't mean in this case that we are going to deal with the prior probability in this probability of HI. We are still going to deal with probability of data given the model. So we can expand probability of data given model in terms of the parameters like this. This is probability of data given theta and HI multiplied by probability of theta given, there shouldn't be a D here, it's actually wrong, probability of theta given HI. So this is just decomposition of this using the parameters. Here theta denotes the parameters for this model HI. Now, this is where the actual distinction between Bayesian and ML-based model comparison comes. For what is the main difference between Bayesian and ML? Prior, that's one thing. So, when you say even a prior, you assume that we have a probability distribution for parameters. So, it's much more fundamental. So, what is that? So why don't we take into account of priors in ML when both are equal? When ML method equals Bayesian method. Right. So in ML method, we don't assume the parameters to be random. We know that, or we assume that the parameters have a fixed value. We just have to find the true value. That's it. But in Bayesian, we have this distribution probability of theta given data or model. So if it's ML method, this would go off. It would just be probability of D given theta at the correct value of theta, the true value of theta. So if we are dealing with the previous ML based model comparison, we'll just have to find the probability of D given theta for the model. That is, if it's say linear model, we'll have p of d given theta for theta for linear model. Similarly, if it's polynomial model, we'll have p of d given the parameters for the polynomial model. For ML-based method, if at least for the example that we took 1, 3, 5, 7, most likely, since the fit is perfect, both the models will give you the same likelihood. Probability of D given parameters for the linear model, or probability of data given parameters for the polynomial model. So ML method would not help you to distinguish between these two. So we can't choose between the models using ML method. So this is where Bayesian method can help. That is, probability of theta given the model will help. So for Bayesian, if you remember, it is common for the posterior to be peaked at a particular value. Do you remember that? That is, as you keep getting data, the posterior distribution becomes more and more peaked at a particular value. I think you must have showed some example for this. So if we assume that the peak happens at this theta hat, then we can approximate this integral using this probability of this is just carried as it is, but this integral of this whole thing becomes probability of theta hat given hi multiplied with delta theta. Do you get how you get from here to here? If it's peaked, you can just assume it's non-zero around a rectangle near this peak, if it's strongly peaked, and the rest are zeros. So this rectangle width is this, delta theta, and the value of this rectangle is this. So this integral becomes this. But how do you find this delta theta? This is an approximation called, it's not mentioned here, but later we'll come to this. The basic idea is we want to approximate a peak distribution using just a rectangle. And one form of approximation is called a Laplace method of approximation. In physics, it's called saddle point approximation. So using this, we can find delta theta. Now, what is important here is to consider this product, P of theta hat given hi multiplied by delta theta. First, if you take the first term, this is just similar to likelihood. This is the probability of data given theta hat. This is actually different from probability of D given hi. For maximum likelihood, both will collapse to be the same. Probability of D given hi is called the evidence for the model given data. That is, how much evidence is there that this model is the correct model given data. But this is the usual likelihood, P of D given theta hat. So the first term can be described as the best fit likelihood. Best fit, it's because theta hat is the most probable in the posterior. This second term means this product, is referred to as the Occam factor, and it's the ratio of the volume that can account for the data by the prior volume without regard for D. This factor has a magnitude less than 1. Now, what this Occam factor means is this. So you all remember what Occam's razor is, right? So the whole idea is to give more weightage to a model that's simple and still can explain all the data, compared to a model that is more complex and still explains just about the same. In this case, the probability of theta hat given hi would be approximately same whether we have a linear model or a nonlinear model, the polynomial model, for the simple example that we took, 1, 3, 5, 7. But this delta theta is, if you take the linear model, we had initially if you take the space of all data that can be explained by linear model, you'll get some space. But after observing data, it will collapse to some extent. Like initially you will assume, say, uniform prior with some range. After you observe the data, it's going to collapse to a smaller range, right? So this volume ratio is the Occam's factor. So at an initial volume, which is uniform over a large range, and then after you observe data, it's going to reduce to a smaller range with a peak. So this reduction in volume is Occam's factor. For something like a more complicated polynomial model, the initial range would be much larger because it can explain, a polynomial model can explain much more data. So if it's uniform in all the parameters, the initial volume is going to be much, much larger. And after you observe data, it's going to collapse significantly. So the Occam's factor is going to be very low. Occam's factor is the volume after the collapsing, after the observed data, divided by the volume before you observe data. So for a more complex model, this would be much smaller. And for simple model like linear model, this would be significantly higher. So this is where the Bayesian approach will really help us in a more quantitative sense to distinguish between a simple and complex models. So you need not actually impose our beliefs, prior beliefs, to decide between what is simple and what is complex. Now, how do you approximate this delta theta? If you assume the posterior is a Gaussian, then the posterior can be calculated directly as this. That is, this delta theta is going to be, the rest is just brought down as it is. This delta theta is going to be approximated as 2 pi for k over 2 multiplied by the determinant of h power minus half, where h is a Hessian matrix, this dou square ln of p of theta given d, comma hi. Actually, there should be a minus here. I don't know if any of you have taken information theory. Have you? Did you take information theory before? Oh, okay. Did you learn about Fisher's information? I don't know whether Fisher information. Fisher, F-I-S-H-E-R. Yeah. Oh, no? Okay. So this is called, in fact, the negative of this. This is the information. This is called Fisher information. For Gaussian, if you evaluate it, this will come to 1 by sigma squared for just a scalar Gaussian. So basic idea is, if you have a smaller sigma, then 1 over sigma squared is going to be very high, which means you have a lot more information. If you had a large sigma, there's no information in the PDF because it's going to be almost like a uniform signal, uniform PDF. There's not much information. So this is known as Fisher information. So this is the determinant of Fisher information, power minus half. This approximation, as I told you before, comes from Laplace method. The idea is you got Gaussian distribution. This works only if the posterior is a Gaussian. So if the posterior is Gaussian, or given a Gaussian PDF, or a Gaussian-like PDF, we can approximate the width of the Gaussian using this. This is the second-order approximation of the width. Note that the data need not be Gaussian. Data in this case is the D. P of D. Data itself need not be Gaussian, just the evidence distribution. This is a reasonable assumption based on the law of large numbers. That is, if you have lots and lots of data, most probably this would be a Gaussian. Combining classifiers. Previously in bagging and boosting, the last class of what we saw was a kind of combination of classifiers, but was different in the sense we just had the same data and the same classifiers, but we just split the data into different parts or did some adaptive weighting and got several classifiers out of it to either to smooth or to get more reliable estimates. But in this combining classifiers, we are going to deal with a method which will help you create more complex classifiers out of a simple one. Like, for example, what you did for GMM, Gaussian mixture modeling. Gaussian model is a simple model. It just had a single Gaussian. By weighting different Gaussians differently and then combining them, what you had effectively was a kind of combining classification. So we have already seen several classifiers whose decision is based on the outputs of component classifiers, like our GMM or even HMM. These are more generally known as a mixture of experts model. We assume each pattern can be modeled by a mixture distribution. Probability of Y given X and capital theta 0 equals, you've got K components. Probability of R given X theta 0 multiplied by probability of Y given X theta 0. So Y would be the probability of, Y is the class assignment in this case. So these are the set of all parameters that we have. Represents the vector of all relevant parameters. Actually, the notation here is slightly bit messy. Anyway, let's look at this figure first. So we have set of component classifiers, 1, 2, goes on till K. Given input X, each of these would create a classification. And we can weight all these differently and then pool these and find a common discriminant function. This is what you did even with the GMM. So you had several Gaussians. Each Gaussian would give you an output, and we just weight all these and get a common classification finding. But the difference here is the weights can be varied depending upon the data that we have. This is called the gating subsystem, which generates these weights adaptively. This is the most common form of mixture of experts. Mixture of experts actually comes from work on neural networks. In fact, my work, what I have here is in my thesis, all these are some kind of autoregressive models, and this itself is one specific flavor of adaptive gating system. We have seen this before in the form of a mixture distribution that models state outputs in an HMM. The weights are constrained to sum to 1, that is, at each time instant, all the weights should sum to 1. The conditional mean of the mixture density is, so if we had each one had created mu1, mu2, till mu k, the common mean would be the just the weighted sum of all these means. The goal in estimating the parameters of the gating system is to maximize the log likelihood of the training data. So that's what we have been doing all along, for most cases. So we can sum up the likelihood of data given parameters using this. A straightforward approach is to use gradient descent. You see here, for Gaussian mixture modeling, we just had constant weights which didn't depend on data. So in that specific case, the weights, you could actually really solve for it and get a maximum likelihood solution. We can take the gradient of the likelihood and then maximize it with respect to the weights too. But if the weights also depend on X, then in most cases it's difficult to find the parameters of this gating system in a closed form. We typically resort to a form of a gradient descent approach. So typically you just find the derivative at a point and see which direction the likelihood is moving upwards, and then move in along the direction by a small step, and then keep repeating this again and again. Note that WAR is the prior probability that the process is chosen given input is XI. So in this, the W's are the prior probabilities. Then you reweight, find new weights for every instant. EM can also be used to estimate the mixture coefficients and is generally preferred today. So, but we can't do this all the time. So, in fact, whenever we can't solve EM works, in EM we have expectation and maximization. So at every step, you know, you find expectation, and then the next step you maximize the likelihood by varying the parameters, right? But we may not be able to do it all this, like what I said, if the weights are going to depend upon the data X, you may not be able to update these parameters to maximize. We can only use a gradient descent approximation. In that case, we just have an approximation. All we are assured of is going towards the direction of maximum. We may not be able to maximize the likelihood by varying the parameters. So in that case, actually, what we deal with is called GEM, or generalized expectation maximization. The final decision rule is to choose the category corresponding to the maximum discriminant value after pooling. An alternative is the winner-take-all method. Choose the single component classifier with the highest confidence. So this, anyway, we know this is what we have been talking since the last class. For every such combination, you can always do this. Either you can find some sort of average between different classifiers, or take just the best classifier among a pool of classifiers. The number of mixture components is typically found experimentally. So this is somewhat a subtle point. So if I give you a training set and an evaluation set, how would you proceed if you don't know the number of mixtures? Say, assume I give you a data set. This is the training set, and part of about 80% is training set, about 20% is evaluation set. So how do you find the optimal number of mixtures? I did talk about it last class. Do you remember that? No? Experimentally we can do this by just, so take, say, just two mixtures. Find the performance on the evaluation data. Then take three mixtures or four mixtures. Find the evaluation performance. Keep doing it, and you can set the optimal number of mixtures. Is this valid? Am I allowed to tune this on the evaluation data? No, why? Right. That's stating because you're not supposed to do tuning after you get the evaluation data. So for that, if you keep doing it that way, that is, if you have the evaluation data and then you keep tuning this, if I give you a different evaluation data, it may not work as well. So your tuning experiment may be biased. So the best way to do it is split the training data into actual training set and a small, say, about, if you had 80% training data and 20% evaluation data, take about 70% as actual training set and about another 10% as development set, which is where you do all the training on, the tuning on. Okay. This topic is quite different from what has been going on in this course. Till now, most of the topics in the course had been more to do with classical pattern recognition, as the electrical engineers do it. But computer scientists, they call it machine learning, and do it with a more artificial intelligence flavor. This is this reinforcement learning is somewhere in between. So there's somewhere in between artificial intelligence and the classical statistical signal processing, because the initial methods on artificial intelligence had nothing to do with statistics. But then most people started realizing they needed to include statistics also and take what electrical engineers used to do more seriously. So that's how they came to reinforcement learning. So today I'll just introduce definitions and terminology and get the basic setup of agent-environment interaction. And next class, Dr. Picconi would take up on the rest of the topics. Anyway, the basic idea behind reinforcement learning is quite simple. This is what we do almost every day whenever we try to learn something new. We can even take, say, a small child learning to walk. Or, if you take a small child which is just about learning to walk, initially it's not going to, just when it starts walking, it's not going to start walking in a steady, confident way. It will probably fall down a few times, and then it will learn on its own. It doesn't really keep watching adults. It might do that, but that's not the complete picture. It doesn't really see the adults walking and then see how adults walk. Okay, this is how their gait is. This is how you have to take your steps. That's not the way a child learns. It starts off just doing small adjustments to it. It falls down, then it learns, okay, it shouldn't do it. If it does certain steps, it'll fall down. So the primary goal in that case is it needs to walk. It needs to get from one place to another place. That's the primary goal. So the first important point in reinforcement learning is a goal. It's to set up a goal. The second point is you need to have a state. So certain states. State is the child senses that it's walking or it's falling down. So these are the states. And the third thing is the reward. If it's able to get from one place to another place quickly or without falling down, then it's got a high reward. If it falls down, then it's got a very low reward or even negative reward. So this is the basic concept behind reinforcement learning. So these slides Dr. Picconi made from some of these references. The main objectives of this lecture are describe the reinforcement learning problem and then precise idealized form of the RL problem for which we have precise theoretical results, and then introduce key components of the mathematics, value functions and Bellman equations. Describe trade-offs between applicability and mathematical tractability. The agent-environment interface. So in our example, the child would be the agent here. So the child that's sitting in this agent, and the action is whether it needs to keep its posture straight, it needs to take the right leg forward or the left leg forward. So these are the actions. Environment, this is not under the child's control. So if it takes certain steps, it might fall down. If it takes certain other steps, it will be able to walk without falling down. So this is the environment, and they are the rewards given by the environment. And then the states. The states are whether it's straight, the child will be able to sense what its states are, whether I'm straight, whether I'm falling down. So these are the states. So basic idea behind this agent-environment interface is this feedback loop. So the agent tries to learn. So when given some state, it does some actions. And the environment gives some rewards. Using this reward, the agent tries to modify its behavior. So it's a kind of self-learning machine. Agent and environment interact at discrete time steps. T, 0, 1, 2, goes on. Agent observes state at step T. ST belongs to this capital S. This is the set of all states. And produces action at step T. A of T, action at time T, is the set of all actions possible when remaining at state T. And gets resulting reward. RT plus 1 belongs to set of all rewards. And resulting next state, S of T plus 1. So this is another way of describing the same thing. One of the things here is the reward. Almost always in reinforcement learning is a scalar value. And it's, in spite of it, it seems to work pretty well. The agent learns a policy. Policy is given state what kind of actions I should take. That is a policy. Policy at state T, that is pi of T, it's a mapping from states to action probabilities. Pi of T of S, A is the probability that action AT is taken equals A. Action A is when S of T equals S. Reinforcement learning methods specify how the agent changes its policy as a result of experience. This is a kind of novel novelty in reinforcement learning. There are two parts to reinforcement learning. One is it needs to explore new possibilities at every when receiving in every state. And the second thing is exploitation of previously learned knowledge. That is, if you had prior, whenever you have prior experience, you should learn from the experience to predict the best possible action that you should take whenever you reside in a certain state. But at the same time, you should also explore, try to explore new avenues or new actions if you have to learn. It's a kind of if you can't do one, you can't do the other. You need to explore to exploit. For instance, whenever when you start, you don't have any knowledge. The child doesn't have any knowledge. It needs to explore. It needs to try to start walking. It might fall down, of course, but it needs to start trying to explore before it knows it learns, and then it's able to exploit the knowledge. So this is a kind of novelty in reinforcement learning. So this always, at every step, there is always a trade-off between exploration and exploitation. How much you want to rely on the previous knowledge, how much you want to take chances and do new things, and then try to get even further new knowledge. Obviously, as time goes on, a good reinforcement learning method would be better at exploitation, and it will stop exploring so much. Roughly, the agent's goal is to get as much reward as it can over the long run. This is the second important point about reinforcement learning. That is, it doesn't just see, I get this present state, I do an action, and I get a reward. It doesn't take only that specific reward, that time's reward into account. So, you remember, I get a state, I take an action, and I get a reward. That doesn't mean that it will take only this reward into account while learning about the action to take for this specific state. What it will do is, it will, given a set of states, it will try to find, it will try to take into account the present and the future rewards into account. Because when you take a false step, you may not fall down immediately. It might take some time before you fall down. You may take a few more steps, but you might have already taken a false step, and probably in future you would fall down. So it's important that it's just not the next step, the next reward that is important. You need to take into account of the future several rewards into account to learn a good action. Learning can occur in several ways. Adaptation of classifier parameters based on prior and current data. Example, many health systems now ask you, was this answer helpful to you? So this you must have surely come across whenever you say, you talk or phone, especially in automated systems or even websites. When you go to certain websites, it'll ask you for feedback. Was this information helpful to you? Information on the web page helpful to you? The basic idea is it's trying to learn automatically how to, what kind of information it should display to better capture more audience or give a better service. Another way, selection of the most appropriate next training pattern during classifier training. Example, active learning. If you remember, learning with queries, this is what we did there. So, you learn initially set of parameters, and then you choose the next best set of training set for which you need truth marking or you need the labeling. So this is somewhat similar to that. Common algorithm design issues include rate of convergence, bias versus variance, adaptation speed, and batch versus incremental adaptation. These are the usual kind of design issues that you face with every parameter estimation or classification problem. Getting the degree of abstraction right. Time steps need not refer to fixed intervals of real time. Example, each new training pattern can be considered a training step. Actions can be low level, example voltages to motors, or high level, example accept a job, mental, example shift and focus of attention, etc. Actions can be rule based, example user expresses a preference, or mathematics based, example assignment of a class, or update of a probability. States can be low level, sensations, or they can be abstract, symbolic, based on memory, or subjective. Example, state of being surprised or lost. In fact, reinforcement learning was inspired from some studies in psychology. So that's why you see all sorts of things like it's being subjective, where it's user expresses a preference and things like these. States can be hidden or observable. Reinforcement learning agent is not like a whole animal or robot, which consists of many RL regions as well as other components. For instance, a robot which, say, needs to collect garbage, that I think is one of the examples which comes later. It needs to, it's not a single reinforcement learning machine. It might have to go and collect garbage. That's the overall goal. But there are several sub-goals, like it should know how to go from one point to another point, or it should know how to estimate how often it's got to recharge itself. So these are, it's the whole robot is made of several reinforcement learning machines. The environment is not necessarily unknown to the agent, only incompletely controllable. Reward computation is in the agent's environment because the agent cannot change it arbitrarily. This is another very important point when if you have to understand reinforcement learning. That is, all the agent can do is, given a state, it can take different actions to control the reward. But it can't control what reward it gets for a specific action. That is completely controlled by the environment. If the child takes a false step, the reward would be obviously be low or negative. That the child can't control. All it can control is what kind of action to take to get better rewards. A scalar reward signal an adequate notion of a goal? Perhaps not, but it is surprisingly flexible. So this is what I said before. In spite of the fact that the scalar reward would be considered by most conventional statistical signal processing people to be somewhat simple, too simple, it seems to be quite flexible and at the same time reasonably efficient. A goal should specify what we want to achieve, not how we want to achieve it. So, in our example, the only goal for the child is to walk from one place to another place. But how it achieves it, it learns by itself. A goal must be outside the agent's direct control, thus outside the agent. The agent must be able to measure success explicitly and frequently during its lifespan. So, the ability to measure success is how the agent is going to adapt itself. If it doesn't know what how to measure success, it won't know how to take different actions or how to learn. It should know how good the child is doing. So it should be able to measure it explicitly, and it should be able to do it frequently during its lifespan. Returns. Suppose the sequence of rewards after step T is R of T plus 1, R of T plus 2, goes on. What do we want to maximize? In general, we want to maximize the expected return, expected value of R of T for each step T, where R of T, this capital R of T, is the sum of all rewards from T plus 1, time T plus 1 to time T, where T is the final step at which the terminal state is reached, ending an episode. That is, let's see this point first. An episodic task denotes complete transaction. Example, a play of game, a trip through a maze, phone call to a support line. So there are some episodic tasks which will have certain tasks you can clearly divide into episodes. So you start a phone call, and there is obviously going to be an end to a phone call. So each whole episode of a phone call, you can take it as one task. So there can be several such episodes. So this is an episodic task. But there are some tasks for which there is no end. You just keep on learning continually. So in that case, this capital T would be infinity. So what we want to maximize, at least when T is finite, would be the overall reward starting from small t, time T plus 1 to the final time step. You want to take the sum of all these rewards and then maximize this at every time step. You can view this as a variant of the forward-backward calculation in HMMs. So that's what you must have read in HMMs too. You not only saw the forward probabilities, also the backward probabilities. Some tasks do not have a natural episode and can be considered continuing tasks. For these tasks, we can define the return as this return R of T is R of T plus 1 plus gamma times R of T plus 2 plus gamma squared R of T plus 3 goes on. And so this, you can compactly write it as summation of 0 to infinity gamma power k R of T plus k plus 1. This gamma is this forgetting factor or discounting rate, since it's between 0 to 1. So obviously, this makes sense because you take an action at time t, you would expect most of the effect on the rewards would be at nearer, very near in the future than much later in the future. So that's why we have gamma between 0 and 1, and you scale it this way. Gamma close to 0 favors short-term returns, that is short-sighted, while gamma close to 1 favors long-term returns. Gamma can also be thought of as a forgetting factor in that since it is less than 1, it weights near-term future actions more heavily than long-term future actions. So this is another example. The goal is to get to the top of hill as quickly as possible. This is an extremely simple example where so you can go up or go down. The state is the height, and the goal is to reach the maximum height. So, yeah, it's quite obvious, should obviously go in this direction. But this is just to give an example of reinforcement learning. So the return, the reward is minus 1 for each step taken when you are not at the top of the hill. And so the return is negative of number of steps. So obviously when you go up, the return will be 0. So till then you are going to have return negatives. Return is maximized by minimizing the number of steps to reach the top of the hill. Other distinctions include deterministic versus dynamic. The context for a task can change as a function of time. Example, an airline reservation system. So, for an example like this, obviously as time varies, the price or what flight schedules and corresponding prices would change as a function of time. So that's a dynamic system. In a deterministic system like this, so it doesn't matter. So wherever you are, it's still deterministic. You're going to have, for this state, this would be the action. Everything is deterministic once you learn the system. Another factor for reinforcement learning is the time to solution might also be important, minimizing the number of steps as well as the overall return. That is, it's not only important that the child learns to walk from one place to another place without falling down, but it's also try to learn it, to do it in the least number of steps or short time. So this could also be another factor to optimize when doing reinforcement learning. Is unified notation. In episodic tasks, we number the time steps of each episode starting from zero. We usually do not have to distinguish between episodes. So we write, actually this is flipped around, so we write S of T instead of S of T, T of T, J for state S at step T of episode J. That is, S of T, J would be state S at step T of episode J. But we don't want to distinguish between episodes in most cases. It doesn't matter whenever you say if the episode is a phone call. You don't want to distinguish between whether I'm calling for the first time or tenth time. It doesn't matter. All that matters is this is an episode and I want to learn what actions to take depending upon what rewards I get for being at certain states. So in that case, we can just mention this as, write this as S of T. Think of each episode as ending in an absorbing state that always produces a reward of zero. So S of zero, you get R1 equals plus one, S of one, so you go to S of one. Then R2 is plus one, you go to S of two. It goes on like this till the final state. This is somewhat similar to HMM. Where you had an initial state and a final state. So once you reach the final state, this is not going to move anywhere. This would also come in Markov models where you have a final absorbing state. We can cover all cases by writing R of T, this is the return, at time T equals summation 0 to infinity of gamma k, gamma power k, r of t plus k plus 1, where gamma equals 1 only if a zero reward absorbing state is always reached. So if you have, if you replace this by gamma equals 1, so it will just be summation of 0 to infinity of r of t plus k plus 1. This is not infinite sum because once you reach an absorbing state, all these returns will be zero. So this would automatically become finite whenever you have an episodic task. When you have a continuing task, you will have this this forgetting factor solution. So this is just a way of unifying both these, this for episodic task and this for a continuing task. You will be just giving a common notation for these two using this. So we'll stop here. Dr. Picconi will pick up from here on Friday. Any questions? Thanks.